Did you know that two women a week die from the results of domestic abuse in the UK alone? And that number is compounded by thousands around the world. Now, my guest today has been in that situation of terrible domestic abuse, and she has written an autobiography about it called Brutally Honest. It is, of course, Mel B, known to millions of people as Scary Spice and one of the originators of the Spice Girls, but has had a huge life which has encompassed many really tough situations. I could easily do the interview where I ask her all about being a Spice Girl and fame and fortune, but to me the conversation here is outwardly facing, you are this worldwide pop star, and inward facing, you are another victim of domestic abuse. And that's a conversation I think we should have. So welcome, Mel B.
Oh, thank you for having me.
I think that so many people know you in such a public way for so many years.
Over a Scary Spice.
A Scary Spice. Spice. But that was 6 years of life as post-Scary Spice with Simon Cowell on all those amazing shows. I think today I want to talk just more about your book because it moved me so much, I can't tell you.
Thank you.
And I felt that it's incredibly candid. And I just want to say here at the top of the show that if you feel you're in a relationship that feels uncomfortable and you're also in a place where it wouldn't be good for you to have a book out on the table that says Brutally Honest, that you download the Audible because you can listen on a little headphone and nobody knows what you're doing.
And be discreet,
And you can be discreet. And sometimes the hardest thing in life, which you go through again and again, is admitting to ourself a situation where it's affecting not just us, but our children and our entire life.
Yeah.
And how long it can take to have the courage to leave.
Yeah.
So to accelerate that journey for women who are currently in that situation, it would be incredible if this interview and them reading your book does that and how many lives you can save.
Oh, I hope so. I mean, that was the whole point of bringing the book out in the first place. Because to be honest, on face value, I thought this was going to completely end my career. Because
the book?
Yeah, because when I was going to publishers, asking them if they could please publish it, it was turned down so many times. And I'm talking about when I first released the book in 2017, 2018. Yeah. It was a topic that everyone knew about, but it was seen as a dirty little secret. We all know somebody that's been in an abusive relationship, or if it's not from ourselves, it's a family member or a school friend or a college friend. But to actually have a book just purely about abuse and the effects that it's had on me and what I did to cope and self-medicate, and then the new revised version coming out of that after 10 years, you know, people think, well, number one, why didn't you leave earlier? And number two, you're out of that now, you should be fine, which are the most
ignorant
questions. But I don't blame people for thinking like that.
And can I just go back there and ask you, had you already, I presume because you're very dyslexic like me, but did you speak it into a microphone?
Well, I actually called my dear friend Louise Gannon, who I know is a fabulous writer. I invited her to LA. I just recently moved out of the family home because he wouldn't move out. I was starting my divorce proceedings. My father died, so that really gave me the energy and the strength to leave that abusive relationship, even though I tried to leave about 6 or 7 times within those 10 years, but from being blackmailed or financial abuse, many of the different types of abuse, I ended up going back, mainly plus for my kids. So it was a difficult predicament that I was in, but I knew I'd almost lost myself in those 10 years and I'd lost what had happened to me. So I called Louise up, invited her to LA. I was like, right, I really want to write a book about what's happened to me. And
How long had it been since you left him?
It was really fresh because it must have been months because Louise had to keep on coming backwards, forwards. The first time she came over, you know, we're good friends. We've known each other for years and years and years. She put the tape recorder down and was like, right, we're going to start talking about it. I need to figure out the bones of what this book is going to look like. And I refused to talk to her. And she went then went back to England. She came back over to LA again, and she was just at a standstill with me. Number one, because...
But you had asked her to come.
I know.
But then when it came to that moment in the room,
yeah,
you couldn't find the word.
I couldn't. So what Louise did is she went away, did a lot of research mm-hmm. on domestic violence, mm-hmm. and then she decided to... There was about 15, 16 people in my life that she interviewed, from drivers to hair and makeup to the guy that did my accounts for X Factor to all these important people that all had a recollection of what happened. Like, for example, the main guy, the money guy for X Factor, saw my money go into my account and saw my money go out of my account. I had no recollection of it yeah. because, number one, I was really embarrassed. I didn't want to have to admit that to Louise, and then mm-hmm. I'd have to admit that to myself. And number two, I had PTSD. I blocked it all out. Mm-hmm. So Louise gathered all this information, gathered all these different stories from different people that were very important in my life, that were very, very well respected throughout mm-hmm. the industry also. And she would say, okay, so this is what, for example, Ben Todd said. Mm-hmm. This is what Simon Jones said, PR. This is what your driver said. And I'd go, oh, no, that didn't happen like that. And then I'd read what they had seen happen or what they'd encountered the yeah. vibe between me and my ex. And I just sunk and I would go, yeah, that did happen. And that was very overwhelming. So about the fifth time Louise came back, she put these 15 like bullet points in front of me. She went, what do you think of that? And I'm like, oh, well, that's the timeline of my marriage. And she said, no, this is from Women's Aid website, and these are the 15 signs of abuse.
That you put in the end of your book.
And yeah. I was absolutely shocked, because it's only then. And Louise was very gentle, because I was so, I don't want to talk about it, even though I really want you to write this book with me, because I'm not a writer like that, but I'm a good, like, storyteller, and it was my story, but I'd missed out so much in my life. She literally pieced my life back together like a jigsaw puzzle. Mm. And because she did it from everybody else's point of view that were very, very well respected, only then could I start to admit stuff and then be able to say it back to Louise from my side of the street. And then it was shocking to me, because I didn't realise how badly abused I'd been. Every level of abuse I had encountered. And then even leaving that abusive marriage, I then had to really, really understand and realise that the money that I thought I'd had, because I worked my ass off for 10 years, I was the only breadwinner of the family. Did America's Got Talent for 7 years, and they pay crazy, ridiculous amounts of money. My money was all squandered, gone. I was like, how is that possible? All I do is work and look after the kids. And that's what an abuser always does. Mm-hmm. Well, as soon as they've got control over you, as soon as they've love-bombed you and shown up like Prince Charming, and I must say it does happen to men too, but it's predominantly happening to women. It's an epidemic. After they've done all that and they've got you on that little reign of theirs, they can just treat you like a puppet and you don't even realise it. It'll go from something nasty to something nice, to something negative that they're saying to you and derogatory, to something nice. Or, here's a dress that I bought you. And you don't really think at the time it's anything other than, oh, they did put me a lovely dress. No, that's because they want to then condition you on what they want you to wear. So you end up having no choice.
When was that very first time? So you get together when you're... middle child is one,
yeah,
or just born.
Yeah, Angel was born April 3rd, and I was married 3 months after that. So they really do come at you, and they intensify everything, and you think they are just your gift from heaven.
So Angel's born, who you had with Eddie Murphy.
Yeah.
But you're single at the time, or you're still with him? You're single at the time.
I'm single at the time.
Are you feeling also vulnerable?
Because
you 100%. Did it end... in a difficult... I know you're friends now and everything's great.
We are
at
friends
the time,
now. Well, at the time, I went through such a public humiliation, because I left him, I went back to Leeds, and then there was a whole thing of, he said on the red carpet, something along the lines, well, we don't know if that baby's mine. And I was, like, devastated. Mm. So even the baby was planned, and Angel knows that, and he apologises profoundly for that. But I said, well, you're going to have to do a DNA test, because I'm not having anybody think that is not a planned baby and that's not your baby.
Yeah.
Obviously, the DNA test came back positive,
yeah,
that he is the father, I'm the mother,
yeah,
yada, yada, yada. And at that time, I was still in grievance because that was essentially the love of my life. And I didn't think I would ever find somebody like that. Not that I was looking, anyway.
Yeah. How long had you gone out together?
Oh, God, it was in secret for about a year. So Eddie asked for my dad, asked for my hand in marriage with this whole thing at this beautiful hotel in LA. And then things went a bit sour,
mm-hmm,
because I'm an independent woman at the end of the day. I'm not a pretty woman. I don't need your credit card and your cars and your, yeah, drivers. I've got my own house, my own money, mm-hmm, my own, mm-hmm, cars. So it was about figuring that relationship. But before we could even get to figuring out, things just started to fall apart, unfortunately. Mm. And we have the utmost respect for each other these days, of, mm-hmm, course, because we have a beautiful child together. But it's like I always say, abusers, you don't find them. You don't wake up and say, right, I'm going to find myself a really nice, abusive husband.
So how did he find you?
That's the point. They find you. He just was happy. He happened to be at the same airport as me, the same restaurant, the same hotel as me. Like, abusers find you and, mm-hmm, they handpick you because know you're an easy target or you're a vulnerable target.
So you kept bumping into him?
Yeah, randomly.
And how did he introduce himself to you?
As, I can't even say his name, but the first name, yeah, Belafonte, and he's not Belafonte. He changed his name so he could appear to be part of that family.
Yeah.
Which is not, that's not his real name.
All right.
And little did I know, he was already convicted of a criminal crime. He met many different crimes and he was already done for domestic violence from a prior partner to me.
Mm-hmm.
And during the relationship, I did find things out, but then, you know, an abuser is very clever and very convincing,
mm-hmm,
to make you feel like, oh, God, that woman, the past relationship, that's just crazy. She's, yeah, just saying that. And I'm thinking, well, you have got something on your court records. Mm-hmm. And then you just get love bombed again. So everything you're trying to do and everything you're trying to believe in, and don't forget, I'm now at a stage where I'm in love with this guy, mm-hmm, because he's presented himself as the best thing since sliced bread. Like, and I'm like, this can't even be real.
Yeah.
And then that's when the coercion and the manipulation starts. It's not like it happens overnight. Mm-hmm. It's not like they get... They're abusive physically or mentally or anything like that straight away, because you just wouldn't have it. And this is why I say abuse can happen to anybody. It doesn't, mm-hmm, matter. It doesn't have an age, a colour, a weight, size. It can just literally happen, yeah, to anyone. And abusers, I always say it's their job. And you're very good at your job. I'm very good at, mm-hmm, my job. Abusers are very good at their job because that is their lifeline. That's their income. That's their safety. That's their control. And that's how
their,
they feel
self-worth,
like a man. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When you're in this relationship and you talk in great detail about the relationship, you have Phoenix, who's listening to this as we are doing this, yeah, podcast. But in the book, and if anyone has read the original version, this has some more chapters. And one of the chapters is Phoenix talking. And you told me just before we went on air that Phoenix actually spoke, because I listened to that this morning.
Yeah, she does her own audio, yeah, and she wrote her own chapter, which... I just couldn't read it until it was more or less publication day. And I read it and I was just floored.
I know. I
was shocked.
I'm just going to, because I have to say that when I read it, it's very interesting when you've read all, in the book, you'll read all about Mel talking about the situation. But then the way that Phoenix describes meeting him and that her life was, you know, the first time I set eyes on Stephen, I didn't like him. My mum, mm-hmm, had just had a baby and I was with my grandma in a hotel room where this big, loud dude appeared, being super friendly and all over her an angel. I wasn't that spoiled bratty brat who never wanted to share her mum. I loved Eddie. As soon as I met him, he was just cool. And then Stephen was all around all the time.
Yeah.
She, first of all... Her description is
spot
so
on.
Mature, spot on,
yeah.
Yet so mature and so painful to read. There must have been times when Phoenix says to you, what the fuck are you doing, mommy? Because Phoenix is a very mature woman, girl, even at 13, I can imagine.
I don't think Phoenix had the know-how what to say, because she did see me very, very happy.
Yeah.
But then she saw me very, very, very sad. So she was just always there for me. I mean, I remember when I would cry, she wouldn't ask me why I would cry. she'd just give me a hug, or she wouldn't ask me why I'm sleeping in her bedroom that was three floors downstairs from my bedroom, which was up on the top floor. She wouldn't ask me any questions. She'd just get into bed with me and I'd go, I'm sleeping in your bed tonight and tonight and tonight again. She was just, I guess...
mothering the mother.
Yeah.
Which, that's, I mean, mothering
which
the mother.
Is not ideal at all. And one thing that has helped me in Phoenix is to talk about it and is to actually do this book, even though I wanted to pull it because I thought it was going to wreck my career and just send everything into disarray. But abuse doesn't just affect you. It affects your children. Mm. It affects your friends, your family. And then you have to go back and you have to make amends because it's not going to be put right unless you actually face it. So when I, you know, in 2019, I left LA, came back to Leeds, back to my hometown, lived with my mother because I had nowhere else to stay. I'd gone from a mansion, then to doing Wembley with the Spice Girls, and then I'm in a small bungalow with my mum and all my kids. And just to have that realisation of this is my life now. And so I've got to, number one, start really understanding what happened. The book helped a lot. And then just trying to put a blanket over my kids again because for so long I thought, well, my bedroom's on the top floor. At least they can't hear that much. Obviously, kids, they feel it. They sense it. And Phoenix told me, I think she did like a whole article. Yet again, I hadn't read it until it came out. I think it was with You magazine, where she actually had witnessed me being sexually assaulted by my ex. And heard me crying and was didn't do anything apart from just sit on the step out of fear and then just cuddled me. And, you know, you, like anybody in an abusive relationship doesn't necessarily have to be physical. It can be emotional. It can be yelling. It can be somebody saying, your partner saying something derogatory to you. I don't care whether your baby's a week old or 10 years old, your kids are going to feel it. Even though you think, well, I can take it for God knows how long. Hopefully I'm going to survive and get out of this and protect my kids. But it has a ripple effect. And that's why it's so important that I speak up about it, even though I've got my MBE for that and bringing awareness. But if one to two women get killed a week by their partner or by their former partner, this is not only a woman problem situation, it's a world problem, and it's an epidemic that's not going to go away. And that's why I've, thank God for Louise, she was saying to me, okay, so when it comes to abuse, we have to talk about those things that nobody else is willing to talk about. The guilt, the shame, the self-medicating, the, oh my God, I'm a bad mum, how can I get through this day? And then on top of it, you are a mum and you are working and you still on your days off have to do the school pick up and drop off. And then you're on a time frame by your partner of where you can go or where you can't go, how long you can't have your phone for or can have your phone, whether you're allowed to have the car keys and this. And one thing I found from going to visit refugees is that all these women that are fleeing these kind of relationships, we all have exactly the same story. So the abusers do exactly the same thing over and over and over again. So if we already know what they do, surely us as a culture and us as women that should not stand for any of that, we have to stand together and make a change, which means changing up the justice system, educating our kids in school so they know what a healthy relationship looks like. Because I think if I would have known what I know now, even those 15 signs, if that was stuck on a, I don't know, a service station door in the toilet, I would have looked at that and I think that that would have surely helped because that I ticked every single one.
Coming across in this and listening to interviews you've done, this is the first element of how I see you growing up. Fucking fearless. You know, there's an there's a sense of you of... when your mother says maybe don't go for this audition or paving the way.
And I went for the audition.
You know, in case you have disappointment. But just where do you think you got that from? Do you think it was because you had installed in you the strong white culture and the strong black culture so you didn't accept anyone who was going to critique?
Well, I think I grew up in a day and age where you got told if you went for an audition, or you're too fat, you're too black. So that was considered okay. You know what I mean? So I grew up just having to have a thick skin. And I think being Northern, you know, I mean, our household is always full of laughter when my mum and dad were together. Full of laughter, full of pranks, but My dad never missed a day at work. He did shift work. So one week he'd do mornings, next week he'd do afternoons, next week he'd do night times. And he was a copper welder, had the same trade, the same job since he was 18.
Yeah.
And so my dad showed me that discipline. Plus my mum worked as a shop assistant in C&A when C&A was open. And then she took on extra jobs at an old people's home, cleaning toilets, and she'd take me with her just so that she had the money to then pay for me to go to dance class. So I got brought up with that very northern attitude, just get on with it. You know, we can go for a pint on a Friday night to the local pub, but apart from that, we're in work mode. And we sit down and have our tea and we don't necessarily talk to much, and we watch Coronation Street and we go to bed early and we get up and do it all over again. So it's very much working class, and you don't complain and you just get on with it. But also my parents taught me that if you're going to get married, you stick at that marriage. Like, if you're going to go in church, in under God, you make that marriage work. So I got brought up very traditional, but very also believe in who you are, you know, in your gut instinct what's right and wrong. And if not, my dad would definitely tell me what's right or wrong. And my dad was always the kind of guy that would say to me, never forget where you come from.
Can I ask you, out of the five of you, who, when you first got together in the Spice Girls, was the most mature?
Well, Jerry, because she's the oldest, but she was also on my wavelength.
No,
she was also on my wavelength.
All right, how?
Because it's like, if I would have said, let's go and climb a mountain, she'd be right there with me. We were
so
just
adventure.
Like, just not just adventure, it was she had my back no matter what. Even if she didn't really agree with some of the stuff, she would have my back, and then we'd discuss it afterwards. But in time, all five of us, because we all kind of, it was like a piece of clockwork that just worked.
Who became friends first? Like, who actually had a proper friendship first, not we're all in the Spice Girls?
No, I don't think. I mean, we all knew of each other. Me, Victoria and Mel C knew of each other because on the dance scene, you all get the same, you know, stage paper. So you all go down to London, you see each other at the same auditions all the time. Yeah. I was upstairs for a cruise audition with Victoria and Mel C, and then there was another audition downstairs for a girl group. So, you know, that kind of world becomes very, very small. And you see each other week in, week out at Pineapple Dance Studios. Oh, you're going for that audition? Didn't get that one, but I've got this one. So it becomes a kind of a really nice, comfortable circuit. So it was us three that really knew each other first. Jerry blagged it and said she missed the audition, probably because she knew she couldn't sing or dance that well. And she said that for herself, I'm not being bitchy. And so she joined later. And then our singing teacher was like, oh, I know Emma Bunton. I give her singing classes because Emma went to Sylvia Young dance school.
The one in London,
And then we all just got together at a point where nobody wanted to sign us. I mean, we'd be doing these, what do you call them? Not workshops, but... you know, when you do a presentation of your music and your dance routines that I used to choreograph and we used to sing all this stuff and do harmonies.
Where would you do these?
At the Strong Room. We'd invite like A&R people, record company people, and everyone was just like, no, it's all about boy bands. And the original Bob and Chris, who got us together, lost faith and they weren't prepared to sign us. So we were like, well, what are we going to do? So we moved into Maidenhead. We were living off the dole, pretending that we were going and job seekers and looking for jobs. And we really were just working on our craft and working on our music and begging people to work with us. Like, we found Elliot Kennedy. He just take that. We love take that. Let's drive up to Manchester and we'll tell him we're going to pay him back. So it was me and Jerry driving up to Manchester.
So would you be the kind of, I don't want to say be thing to the other ones, but would you be the one saying, come on, you know, you're like head of the dragon.
100%. And then we all had a role to play, but it all just fell into place. Where I would be very loud and I'd snatch somebody's questions if they've written them down on paper. Like, no, you can ask us off what you feel.
Emma would be going, oh, I'm sorry. Did you feel, because I think as you do this kind of work and anything, there's a, you're already in elements nearly a grown up. But we're not really, because you're 18, 19, 20. But in this time, did you see yourself like you know when those people who leave their body when they've died and they look down on it? But did you see, okay, let me, I can lean into that even more. You know, as you, did you see, let me see how I can develop this character of mine?
No,
You didn't.
No. So I think between the five of us, we felt like the misfits that had come together. So we really embraced each other's, like, little quirks and personalities. Like, I was always into leopard print. Victoria was like, I just want to look glam and posh and simple black dress. We all just came to the party with our own misfit thing.
Yeah, I think what I mean.
But my character was always the same. And it's not even really a character.
No,
it's
your personality. It's like with Susanna and I on What Not to Wear, there was this yin and yang, right? Yeah. So there was always, Susanna was always...
And you love each other and you hate each other, but it just works.
Yeah, but in terms of what's interesting about being intently connected, we were intently connected for 10 years and then we weren't. So when we were intently connected, I thought that I was tall, angular, she's curvy and motherly in the way that she's emotionally, like, whatever, whereas I am articulate and would just say it. But, you know, we sort of then lent into half of ourselves to make this whole. So therefore, when it ended, I took me a while to realise I could, and also she was very funny, so I thought I wasn't. Do you see what I mean? So I allowed her to be even funnier, and I wasn't as funny because she was so funny and so much funnier than me. So I sort of kept that down. So only when we separated from each other did Susanna realise I can actually have Trini's work ethic,
which she
didn't have necessarily when we were together. And I realised I could be as funny as Susanna. But I had kept it. When you're in this sort of thing where other people do an element of something differently or maybe better than you. So when you left, was there a part of
the
you?
The thing is, we haven't really left. Publicly, we've kind of gone off and done our own thing. Victoria, very successful. Yeah. Mel C's all over to do doing a GJ. Yeah. Emma's doing her baby branding. Jerry is doing her thing. I'm doing my thing. Yeah. But we haven't actually left each other. I think because what we went through was so life-changing.
Profound.
And the Eye of the Storm is very calm. We were very calm together. We were just like giggling girls, like, can you believe we've gotten away with writing these lyrics, writing these songs, and it's gone number one in 36 different countries. Yeah. But let me just get back to what you were saying. I think now because I'm 49, I can analyse certain things in certain ways and get to grips with it. As well, I've had a lot of therapy. But at the time, I know when I wore that outfit and when I said that and when I did that, that was just me. And if I was to do it all over again, I would be just me.
Yeah.
You know, I think even if you put me in a situation like I was at Buckingham Palace today with my daughter, and my daughter's saying to me, so do we bow, do we curtsy? And I'm like, do what you want, just be respectful. And then I've got Dame Kelly saying to me, it's mam as in jam, not mom as in farm. And I'm trying to repeat what she's saying back to Phoenix.
Chinese
Phoenix,
whispers.
Phoenix is going, so what the fuck do we do? And then we just both turned to each other, leant on this beautiful marble beautiful marble, what do you call those?
Side table.
Yeah.
Kind of thing, yeah.
And then we just went, what the fuck are we doing here? And we've both got these badges on with these perfect little red dots going, we are at Buckingham Palace about to meet the Queen. And then we both just stood, faced forward, and then just was in silence watching the Queen come down the line getting panicky. But she made us feel so comfortable. And I'm thinking in my mind, I'm not here for Spice Girls. I'm here because of Women's Aid. I'm here because of, you know, bringing awareness to domestic violence. And my daughter does a lot of stuff for Women's Aid also. She goes into schools and makes sure that kids understand what a healthy relationship looks like. But, you know, I'm just like a girl from Leeds, from a council estate. Yeah. And then I think I did both, as I usually do. I not only curtsy, but I bow and do my hand and say, hello, Your Majesty.
Because it's that northern...
Is that
I'm
going to
say
thing.
Generalistically, love of the royal family,
me.
And be respectful.
Yeah, and my dad would be so proud.
Yeah.
He'd be just like beside himself that I'm there at Buckingham Palace and I've met the King, I've met the Queen, you know, I've met Prince Harry, Prince William. He would just be beyond words.
Yeah.
But, you know, put me in that situation years ago and I was there kissing... Well, now King Charles, Prince Charles on the cheek and me and Jerry were pinching his bum.
Yeah.
You know, so it is, I mean, the older you get, the more...
You've matured
less
as a lady.
You get, and less like, oh, I'm just going to do this. You become a little bit more refined, but I am still me, she says, sitting here with a full headpiece on and
I have felt that I was in that lost era Mel, because I didn't follow the Spice Girls as a teenager. I was already an adult. So,
right.
So it was kind of different for me. And I wasn't so old that my kids followed. Do you realize? I was in that real in between. But when I occasionally still went to a nightclub, I would definitely dance to all your songs. Gosh. But I was that was me. All right. So I'm not good at this understanding.
That's okay.
But I knew it. What was interesting is even though it wasn't something, I was so aware of it, even though I didn't follow your music. That's how insane.
It was very
huge.
Pop. And that's what we were all about.
Yeah.
A time when it was just all boy bands pop.
Yeah.
Girls weren't
but
even
I think,
getting a look
I think
in.
What I was going to say is, even then, I remember when I met you a few years afterwards and we did 7 days on the Breadline, going to Leeds, your hometown. And
yeah.
I live with Christine Walker. I remember her now. She's died in this two up, two down. And she was disabled and just spent all her money.
Yes, yeah.
She spent all her money in the Chinese shop and gambling. And
yeah.
She had married, she'd married a man of colour. She'd had lots of kids. They weren't around so much, and we couldn't spend money on them. But we had to do stuff. So you and I were like on it. I mean,
I had loads of kids that I had to look after.
Yeah, but it was we only met very quickly at the beginning, and then at the end. But I remember we had some other people there. But I remember I was interested to meet you because I remember even at the time, and this memory came back to me, I knew you were going to be the person I thought you were. You know, so much. Whereas
what
I've met,
what you see is what you get.
Yeah, and I have met the other members of your group on different occasions, and they've sort of been that. But there's something that's there's a rawness and a honesty and candor about you that I identify with very strongly because I don't have I'm not good at having.
You don't have a filter.
I don't have
basically
such a good filter. All right, so we identify with non-filtered
people.
But I
really like that because the last thing you want is to meet somebody and you can see behind their eyes they're speaking but they don't even know what they're saying and it's not even registering.
Yeah.
And they're not being their authentic self. That's why I respect you so much because you are who you are. You're not embarrassed of it. You're not ashamed of it.
Yeah.
And you celebrate and you're very successful.
Yeah, things are good, but it's still about you. I want to ask
you something. Yeah, but I like saying stuff about you too.
Can I just say that's so nice and I appreciate it. You said Phoenix talks in schools about domestic abuse.
Yeah.
So how did that come about? Because that's a huge deal that
it is.
You've got a mother and a daughter
on
this quest to help and just, you know, for those kids to have a voice. This is a really powerful thing, but how did that come about?
Well, I think I think it was like 2 days before publication, I was talking to Louise and Phoenix and I just want to pull this book because I've got a horrible feeling it's going to end my career. And I don't think I want to air my dirty laundry like that because there's nobody else talking about this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Apart from me remembering Tina Turner in that old movie that she did, What's Love Got to Do with It?
Yeah, I remember that.
There's no other person that I can identify with that's talking about it. You know, since then you've got the Jeffrey Epstein, you've got Weinstein.
Yeah.
So you've got the Me Too movement, you've got all that stuff that has happened, but back then,
but there was
nothing.
Yeah.
So my daughter, very profoundly, and I think I'm guessing she felt rage that I'd gone through this and put my kids through this,
mm-hmm.
but probably didn't have the words to say it. But she was like, you have to do this because if you're not helping anybody, who else is going to help these people? And Louise more or less said the same thing to me and gave me a smack on the hand.
How old was Phoenix when she said that to you?
Oh, God, she must have been 16. Were you 16 or 17, Phoenix?
She's probably in the other room looking. But I find that...
But she was brought up very much, don't forget, almost mothering me, but not seeing things, but not showing it.
Mm-hmm.
And she never complained, did Phoenix? So she was always that kind of rock. And I guess because she saw how embarrassed I felt and how guilty and ashamed I felt. But then I'd go off and do America's Got Talent for 10 hours filming. Then I'd come back home all glammed up and it would just be a whole different situation.
Yeah.
And
kids bury things deep, though.
They
do. So when does it come out?
Well, we talk about it a lot. And Phoenix has gone.
And she will.
Well, Phoenix hates therapy.
Mm-hmm.
She does not want to touch therapy.
Yeah.
I'm more of the person that, not so much about the abuse, but now I'll go to alternative therapy because I find talking about it feels like I'm reliving it again.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I couldn't do my own audio for the book. I got a great lady from Leeds to do it who did it more justice than I could ever do. But, I mean, our kids are an extension of us. Mm. And just as me and Phoenix were going through stuff, don't forget I was living at home with my mum, and I'm going through stuff with my mum also, saying, look at my mum going, why didn't you come and save me? You knew what was going on. But as well as Phoenix, and my kids were almost being emotionally abused, so were my friends and so were my family. Mm-hmm. So it was a real coming together in 2019 of really, like, we've got to talk about this stuff because my dad had died. My dad was my rock. Mm-hmm. Phoenix, you know, that's my oldest child. I want her to feel safe and loved and unconditional, which she knows that I have with her. Implicitly, but it was that bridge between how do you apologize to your kids enough but still get the respect of being a mum, but you are just so sad that you've done that to yourself and done that to your kids.
I watched the film that you made. Was it for Woman's Aid?
It was.
And it was an amazing film. The director was fantastic. But in the film, you are reenacting an element of your life.
A scene from my life, 100%.
So, how was that to do?
Really cathartic. And the guy that I was doing the scene with said, I don't want to throw it, because he's a dancer. The whole thing was choreographed like a dance. Mm. And I looked at one of the takes and I said, it doesn't look real enough. It doesn't. I said, you have my consent. You need to push me on the floor. You need to throw me down. Yeah. Then you need to spit on me, because that is what happens. And after a while, he went like for a break, and he came back and he said, I've never spoken about this, but I witnessed my father being like that to my mother. And I was like, wow. I said, so what we're doing, we want this to be as real as possible. So even though it's shocking to people that have never been abused before, at least we're portraying a scene that is really common, that happens to women day in, day out, that happened to me. Mm. And once he got his mind behind that, like, we are standing up and showing what happens behind closed doors, it was brilliant. I mean, we really went for it. And then you've got
really
the scene.
He really punched you in the stomach and you just, you know, you see that. And
Really, but he didn't actually punch me, but he went about an inch
But you don't, you know, the film is portrayed so you don't know how it ends. All you see is that going in and then you running and then you having bruising all
but
over your face.
But what happens is the composer has this beautiful piano melody playing and that's what it's like. You're living, I mean, like I was living this beautiful dream life in my mansions. I've earned all my money and it's beautiful. You've got opera music, but then behind closed doors, that's happening. And you're being strangled. You've been sexually assaulted. You've been told what to wear because then there's a party downstairs for you. Yeah. Oh, so you have to put on a brave face and pretend you love your husband. And maybe at that point, all the bad memories go away and you go, oh, so you are kind and gentle. But then as soon as everybody's left, it goes back into that. And then you end up, and a lot of women do end up in this situation where they're literally running out of that house with nothing on their feet and in their dressing gown, which is how the movie ends. Yeah. And by the way, all the people on set were like, well, we can just clear the manure off the field. And I was like, no, I want this to feel as real as possible.
Yeah.
And within that production, there wasn't one person on that production that hadn't witnessed abuse themselves or had a family member go through it. And when you're so open and honest and it comes from a place of you want it to be better for somebody else, you'd be surprised how many people come into battle with you for the right reasons.
Yeah.
And I think that's what's happened with this book. I think that's what's happened, hopefully, by me being patron of Women's Aid. Mm-hmm. Is not only am I re-educating and helping people, out of anything, I'm helping myself because I'm a survivor too.
It's been such a pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much. Everybody,
thank you.
Give it up for Mel B. Saying I so enjoyed that interview sounds odd because it was a very heavy conversation for a part of it. But what I love the most is she is a woman who knows and loves herself and knows herself entirely. And it's so refreshing to speak to someone like that. And I think that the courage she's had to tell her story so that other women cannot feel alone and can maybe begin to identify if they are in a situation of abuse is something that is, it's just a very powerful message. And I'm just going to read out these 15 signs. So if you are watching and you know somebody or you could be in this situation, you can think that at some stage you might want to change it. So I'm just going to read you the end, the 15 signs of domestic abuse. Domestic violence doesn't look the same in every relationship because every relationship is different. But one thing most abusive relationships have in common is that the abusive partner does many different kinds of things to have more power and control over their partner. Some of the signs of an abusive relationship could include a partner who tells you that you never do anything right, shows extreme jealousy of your friends and time spent away, keeps you or discourages you from seeing friends and family members, insults, demeans, or shames you with put-downs, controls every penny spent in the household, takes your money or refuses to give you money for necessary expenses, looks at you or acts in ways that scare you, controls who you see, where you go, or what you do, prevents you from making your own decisions, tells you you're a bad parent or threatens to harm or take away your children, prevents you from working or attending school, destroys your property or threatens to hurt or kill your pets, intimidates you with guns, knives, or other weapons, pressures you to have sex when you don't want to or do things sexually you're not comfortable with, pressures you to use drugs or alcohol. Many people listening to this might have a few things on that checklist, but Mel had all of them. And it's amazing how it takes leaving it to see it. So the more that she can help women when she tells her story to be able to get out of these relationships, it will be fantastic. And if you're listening to this and you feel affected by this podcast, please get in touch with either thehotline.org, refuge.org.uk, or womansaid.org.uk. Thank you for listening, and we'll catch up again soon.